When we turn to the Bible to see what it teaches about being single, the category is not so clear as we make it. There would seem to be three groups, for example, mentioned in 1 Corinthians 7, the unmarried, the widows, and the virgins. Each of these we find there. The unmarried, I'm opening 1 Corinthians 7, the unmarried are mentioned in verse 8 and verse 11, where they're linked with widows, and the discussion concerns marriage and separation. In verse 32 and verse 34, they are linked with virgins, and the discussion is about getting married. The widows are mentioned in verse 8, linked with the unmarried and discussing remarriage, and then again, not by the word widow, but in concept, in verses 39 and verse 40, where the chapter ends. The virgins are only mentioned in the last third of the chapter, always translated in the ESV as the betrothed, which I think is particularly unhelpful, but they occur frequently there, verse 25, 34, 36, 37, 38. The passage is about the virgins. There seems to be a transition in the chapter from Paul's answer to the Corinthians' question in verse 1, now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, through his discourse on contentment in verses 17 through to 24, only let each person lead a life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him, this is my rule in all the churches, to his answer of the Corinthians' second question in verse 25, now concerning the betrothed, the virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. The virgins only occur in that last section, which is discussing marriage, whether or not to, while the first section is discussing sex. Sex in marriage, porneia, self-control, the possibility of being defiled by sexual relations with an unbeliever. From our point of view, then, when we talk of singleness, we need to recognise the different kinds of singleness that can be on view and the different reasons for singleness. For while the widow, the divorcee, the virgin are all single, that is, they're not at that moment married, their circumstances of life and the advice given to them can be quite different. Jesus spoke of eunuchs, a group of singles, mercifully not common in our society today, but he spoke of them literally, and I take it metaphorically, when he said in Matthew 19 to his disciples, for there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this, receive this. Each of these men were the same. They were single, they were eunuchs. But each were completely different because of the reason why they were eunuchs. And even widows differ according to their age and sexual activity. The widow is completely free to remarry, only in the Lord, of course. Though in verse 8, they're told that they should marry. And in verse 39, she is told that she'd be happier if she didn't marry. The difference is the sexual issue of verse 8. For there Paul is dealing with widows who are not exercising self-control. Notice, it's a present indicative active. It's nothing to do with cannot. Cannot is actually not in the text. It's not saying they cannot exercise self-control. It's saying they are not exercising self-control. If a widow is not exercising self-control, she should marry, is what is being said. Now, again, because of our Christianized way of thinking, we are not thinking of Christian widows who are sexually active. We think, how can that be? And the answer is Corinth. And the answer is Sydney. This would then make sense of another widow passage, 1 Timothy 5, where Paul directs the younger widows should remarry, bear children, and manage their households, for he fears that their passions will draw them away from Christ when they desire to marry. The young widow is seen to be in spiritual danger from having too much time and energy on her hands, and so being provided for by a pension can lead her to being a busybody, a gossip, as well as in danger of sexual drives. How sad it is when we see, as we have, as I have, young widows entering into marriage with an unbeliever, taking their Christian children into an unbeliever's home. There are strong issues in our sexuality that Paul recognises and sees the need some have to normalise our behaviour in holiness by marriage rather than continuing in the unholiness of porneia. Chapter 7, verse 2 is not talking about the temptation to sexual immorality. The word temptation is not there in the text. It's talking about sexual immorality. The problem in Corinth was not that there was a possibility of. The problem in Corinth was there was the active practice of. The widow, the unmarried, already caught in sexual behaviour, are told to marry. Though the older widow, or the one content with her place in life, are encouraged to stay single. Which brings me to my second point, the green grass. Of 1 Corinthians 7, verses 17 to 24, and I read, "Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. For neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. Each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a slave when you called? Do not be concerned about it, but if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. He who is called in the Lord as a slave is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who is free when called is a slave of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. So, brothers, in whatever condition each was called, there let him remain with God." That is, before looking at the second question of Corinthians 7, that is verse 25, and should virgins marry, we have this paragraph in verses 17 to 24, which makes no reference to marriage, to sex, to widows, or anything seemingly that the chapter is dealing with. Here's a paragraph on circumcision and slavery. If it had been removed, I suspect most of us wouldn't have missed it. There are several passages like that in Paul's writing. 2 Corinthians 6, 14 to 7, 1. If you took that out of 2 Corinthians, I think most people wouldn't notice that it had gone. And famously, 1 Corinthians 13. You read 1 Corinthians 12 and then just go straight on to chapter 14 and you won't even miss chapter 13. But yet, of course, chapter 13 is what chapters 12 and 14 is all about. Without chapter 13, you don't actually have the answer that you need. Likewise, if you remove this passage, you'll miss the key to understand what the whole argument is about. For the key is the commandment of verse 17. Let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. And rephrased at the end of the paragraph, verse 24, so brothers, in whatever condition each was called, there let him remain with God. It's not that you're called to the condition. It is when you were called to God, you were in this condition. Circumcision and slavery are the two issues that he uses to illustrate the command, which has been applied to marriage in verses 1 to 16 and is about to be applied to marriage in verses 25 following. It's the acceptance of God's sovereignty over your life, which is not the same as fatalism. For should you have the opportunity to gain freedom, then the slave should do so. And remember, if there is a good reason, such as in the case of Timothy, well, Paul had him circumcised. There's nothing wrong with having a person circumcised. There's nothing right with it. It's an irrelevance. So you can, but you don't have to. So you shouldn't look to, but if you need to, is the kind of argument. But what is key is the acceptance of God's rule over our life and the relative unimportance of the circumstances of life in which we find ourselves. Discontent is deep, especially deep in wealthy person's psyche. And the Australian culture is built on discontent. We have been grumblers, whingers and complainers from the very time of white settlement here. And as we have grown in wealth, we have not removed our grumbling discontent. We are restless now in our wealth, as well as whingers. Paul is pointing out that it doesn't matter to a Christian whether they are circumcised or not, slave or not, because the Christian identity and purpose in life is far greater than either slavery or circumcision. We are the Lord's people. Who cares? Who cares whether we are in this life circumcised or slave, free or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, Roman, Greek, male, female, old, young, married, widow, single, parent or grandparent? It doesn't matter. Those things are insignificant compared to being the Lord's person. These are the things of this world. But in Christ, our identity and purpose, our value and self are as citizens of the kingdom of heaven that is yet to come, of which we now are already participants. Australian citizenship is a wonderful thing to have now in this lifetime. If you can get it, claim it. And if you have it, use it. In other words, become a missionary. But it ultimately doesn't matter. For we are committed to a citizenship that is infinitely more important than Australian citizenship. And when our day is done and we're placed in a box to be taken to the grave or the crematorium, who cares what your citizenship is then? The only passport of value in a coffin is the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, carved onto your very heart. So we have to look to the green, green grass of home and not too much worry about the green grass over my neighbour's fence. For our discontent, our envy, our rivalry is usually about the things of this world, not about the things of the next. Where your heart is, there your treasure will be also. As God's people, we're living in this world. But as God's people, we're citizens of the next. And it's here that we hear each other say, here in this world, that we hear each other say, you just don't know what it's like. And you know they're right. The married person doesn't know what it's like to be single anymore. And the unmarried person doesn't know what it's like to be married. And the widow will tell you, you don't know what that's like either. And as question came last time in our session, it's so long since I've had children, little children, living in my home, I don't remember what that's like either. The older you get, the less you remember. And so you just forget what it's like. I was reminded 2 weeks ago, because we minded three of our little ones, our grandchildren, and one of them vomited from midnight till 5 o'clock. And I remembered. And I also realised why it is that God gives children to young adults. See, everybody is right in this regard. I don't know what it's like being single or widowed. I am a thoroughly, utterly married man. I have lots of friends who have told me, but that's different to actually understanding the whole experience. That's just particulars they can tell me about. I left home to come to Moore College. In third year, I left the singles quarters to get married and live in Little Queen Street. I have never had to fend for myself in life as a single person. There are 19-year-old university students who know more about living as single people in this world than I have ever experienced or know. And therefore, I have to be very careful to offer any advice or wisdom about living as a single person in our city and ministering as a single person, because I am a profoundly married person. But even as a married person, I'm no longer the father of little children. I'm the grandfather who worries about middle-aged children. Not that I'm wholly ignorant. I've spent a lifetime serving single adults in ministry and have worked alongside a large number of single colleagues who have been absolutely terrific, I may say. And from them I've learnt a lot Strangely, the one I've learnt most from was my old boss, John Chapman, who shared with me so much of his life over the 40 or so years with which we worked and loved each other. But even so, as a married man, I don't remember what it was like to be single. And when I was single, it's not single like you meant it to be single. I was still being looked after by my mother. So if you're like me, then you have to be very careful and sensitive about what you say or imply about what single people could, should do, or should or couldn't do. I warn you. However, it's very tiring for Christians to be playing the "you don't know what it's like to" game. You know the game? You don't know what it's like to have nobody at home to come home to. You don't know what it's like to come home to screaming children and an exhausted wife. But you don't know what it's like to have nobody to go on holidays with. You don't know what it's like to always have to go to only child-friendly holiday places. You don't know what it's like to have to nobody to celebrate birthdays with. You don't know what it's like to have to buy your own kitchen stuff because you were never given a kitchen tea. You don't know what it's like to have no wedding anniversary, no Mother's Day, no Father's Day to celebrate. Yes, but you don't know what it's like to have to sit up all night with a sick child and then to go to work the next day. You don't know what it's like to have to put up with children's birthday parties and spend the next day, week, cleaning up the mess that a dozen urchins have made in your house. You don't know what it's like to lie awake worrying about the teenager and whether they will come home and in what state they'll come home and what state the car will be when they come home. But you don't know what it's like to find a flatmate. And then to see them get married and have to find another one. And then to work out whether you can live with them or not live with them and how to get them to leave. And but you don't know what it's like to have no nice clothes and nowhere to go out and wear them because you're stuck at home all day with kids and in your tracky dacks kind of covered in vomit. Friends, this game is endless, isn't it? And while humorous, profoundly, deeply, unchristian and stupid. The game is of envy, rivalry, discontent, grumbling. That sounds like the works of the flesh, doesn't it? The world is a fallen, sinful place. You will never get what you want in this world because it is a fallen, sinful place. You won't get everything you want. And when you do, you may easily resent having gotten it. Be careful what you pray for. We need to be kind and sympathetic, thoughtful and helpful to each other, listening to what the problems are and seeking to help each other with the problems as we see them. Several widows have told me how hard it is to walk into a meeting by themselves. They have nobody there that they're sure will be there, that they're certain they can sit with. Once inside in the Christian family, they usually find their way easily. But outside, before they walk in, they found it so difficult that I've had several of them told me that they got back in the car and went home because they couldn't face walking in the room. It's a real problem that may never have occurred to me without being told about it. But it's not a very difficult problem to address, is it? Having been told it's just the simple matter of me remembering them and their need and to make sure that I meet them outside and bring them in, or that I offer them a lift so that they can come with me, and to make sure that when I see them I call them over to come and sit with us. It's not a hard problem to solve once you know the problem is there. Identify the problem, deal with it. But don't go on grumbling and discontent because life isn't fair. No, it's not fair. And it's not going to be fair until the Lord Jesus Christ returns. Nobody said it was going to be fair outside the Garden of Eden. Furthermore, it comes close to rejecting, and it does more than close to, the sovereignty of God over our lives. Created in God's image, we expect to control things. But of course, we can never control anything without God, unless the Lord builds the house. Those who labour, labour in vain. We have come to terms with this fact that most things are well and truly beyond our control. If you haven't come to terms with that fact, I pity your spouse. But we also have to come to terms with the fact that our loving Heavenly Father is working in everything for our good. I may not have wanted to be born a eunuch or to have other men make me a eunuch, but if that was my Heavenly Father's choice for me, though it is not my choice, though it's part of the fallenness of the world, yet my Father knows best, and I must make most of the situation of life that God has placed me in. Paul is illustrating it with circumcision. With slavery. I may not choose these things, but if that is what God has chosen for me, then I must learn how to live with that. Now, I've chosen to illustrate it myself by using the eunuch, because in some ways it's closer to our issues, where many people who would like to marry are unable to do so. And it's also far enough removed from our circumstance that I'm not talking about those who didn't choose to marry or who weren't chosen to marry. For many people, it's not their choice, but the choice or the lack of choice of others. They would gladly marry, they would gladly have children, but in our system and structure, they have not been able to find the right connection, the right conversation, the right relationship to ever pull it off. And so they can feel disappointed. They can feel unloved. They can feel negative about their life. They can feel negative about marriage. They can feel negative. It's sad. It's awful. But if that is what the situation is, what am I going to do about it? I know some who have acted. One dear sister of mine, she went on an internet dating service, found a Christian, brought him around, got me to screen him, 2 or 3 hours of the hardest hours of his life in my back garden. And they're married and have been so for more than 15 years, happily and joyously. A couple of men, friends of mine, could not ever persuade any girl to go out with them or to even look at them, and so they went to the Philippines and answered newspaper advertisements and, in a sense, purchased a bride from the Philippines, came back to Australia, bought the whole bride's families out as payment for marrying this, as happy as Larry, delighted, both husband and wife. Some people, faced with this issue, say, okay, well, I'm going to deal with it. And they do. I know some who have accepted it. And they've said, I'm going to make a life without marriage. It's not my choice, but it's the choice that's been given to me. So what am I going to do? I'm going to get on and live under this. Some who have not had children have said, okay, well, if we don't have children, that opens up opportunities for us to do other things. One woman who ran the children's ministry in a parish I was in for 40 years, she ran that ministry. She ran it because she didn't have children herself, but used her childlessness to serve the families and the children of that suburb for 40 years. And then I know some who have grumbled and complained, neither acting to resolve the issue nor accepting the reality and making something of it. I feel for all three in their predicament, but I'm sure the last option is the worst option, because it fails to accept that God has your interests at heart. He knows what he's doing, and you're to make the most of what God has given you. So let me talk about the other two options under point three, creation and the kingdom. For while most of our disappointments we put down to the fall, in fact, there's another aspect that I'm not sure we factor into our thinking sufficiently. That is, marriage is part of the creation. Genesis 1, God had made us male and female, that together and as humanity we would multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. It's in that context that the description of the creation of the woman takes place in chapter 2. He cannot be united to any of the other animals, but only bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh. And his union with her is a family union, leaving parents to cleave to her. Not surprisingly, the judgment upon her then falls on her relationship with her husband and her reproduction of children, just as the judgment falls upon him in his work as a gardener in chapter 3. That is, the unity of humanity in reproduction to multiply, fill the earth, lies at the centre of marriage within the scriptures. And this, I take it, is picked up in Malachi 2, where we read, "Did not God make them one, with a portion of the Spirit in their union? And what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. So guard yourself in your spirit, and let none of you be faithless to the wife of your youth." Now, I understand this passage is a very difficult piece of Hebrew for our translators, and I'm assuming the ESV is correct. My Hebrew is not that strong that I would want to make the absolute statement on that one way or t'other, but I can see what they've done, and it's an improvement on the NIV. But you can see, again, the idea of unity is linked to reproduction. You see, the creation of and marriage is linked in purpose to reproduction. What God was desiring was godly offspring. I'm afraid we've moved too far in our understanding of marriage away from reproduction towards psychological intimacy and as an antidote for loneliness, looking for a spouse who will meet our needs for affection and intimacy in soul and in body. Little wonder that we find marriage disappointing. Little wonder that the homosexual community wants to have the same thing. I was interested to read a few years ago a book by Simon Zreter, S-Z-R-E-T-E-R, and Kate Fisher, published by Cambridge University Press, called Sex Before the Sexual Revolution, 1918 to 1963. They did what I always wanted to do but don't have the millions of dollars to get someone to go and do for me. They interviewed old people in the late 1990s about what their life was like, what their marriage was like, what their sexual practices were like before the sexual revolution. It's oral history, not statistical history, so you've got to be careful what kind of generalizations you can draw from it. But most of the thing, it's very careful. Zreter is a Cambridge historian. It's a very careful piece of oral history with all qualifications put out for you. It's a lovely book. In many ways, frustrating in many ways, because he keeps giving you snippets of their conversation and you'd like to see the full transcript because it is so interesting, actually. What is interesting to see is how they saw sex as something, these are the old people, saw sex as something completely private, just between the couple, not to be even talked about, discussed or learnt about until after marriage. There's no point sexual education prior to marriage because you weren't going to have sex before marriage. So it was completely ridiculous and irrelevant to have sex education beforehand. And afterwards, well, marriage was the fun of finding out for yourself, so why would you have it then? More interestingly is their view of marriage itself. It was much more a social and functional idea than ours. It's what you did as a responsible adult. It was the rite of passage. When you grew up and you were a man and you were a woman, well, then you showed you're a man and that you're a woman because you left mum and dad and set up your own home. It was a sign of being an adult. That's what you did. And the spouse you chose, you didn't choose for romantic reasons, but totally practical reasons about having a family and running a household. I married her because she made her own clothes. I married him because he was very clean, always had a bath each week. They were the reasons that people gave for the person they chose. We married him because we knew his family. They lived around the corner and up the road from us, and so we knew them, and that's why we married them. When asked about romance, they fell about laughing, if you can do that as an old person without breaking your hip bone, because they all saw that as imposed upon their culture by Hollywood in the 1930s and 40s, and completely ridiculous. They laughed at the idea of falling in love through having a kiss and then getting married and living ever after. It was just a stupid fictional folly as far as they were concerned. It was interesting to see the shift. Zreter was quite taken aback by this because he's worked in the area. He had a historical kind of view of what marriage was about, and the evidence he found from these conversations didn't fit his view at all. These people were profoundly happy, and even happy in their sexuality, though they hadn't had the necessary school education in sexuality. These people were happy because they married people that were just like them rather than people they'd fallen in love with. These people, it was a very interesting exercise to read the book. But as I see it, not he sees it, but as I saw from what he wrote, we've moved in a four-step program. We've moved from a view theirs, early 20th century, I'm an adult, I want a family, therefore I'll get married, and that means I'll have sex in order to have children. Two, I am romantically attracted to this person, therefore I'll marry them, therefore I'll have sex, and as a result I'll have children, and as a result I'll have a family. Two, later in the century, I am falling in love with that person, therefore I'll have sex with them. We'll set up home with each other, and when we have children, we'll look at getting married before divorce. Two, I'm watching a lot of dirty movies, let's go and have sex. We'll have set up home together, let's avoid children, we'll get some dogs. And dogs are much better than children because when you have an overseas trip, you can put them down. So, let's return to creation view of marriage about children and reproduction. That is, marriage is not the end point of our existence. That's our union with Christ as the bride of Christ. It's now, as we're living in the created order of reproduction, that we are to live, and without it, we can feel a great loss because we're created that way. So should we marry, we who have never been married? The virgin growing up in the young girl growing into adulthood. Paul's advice and answer to that question in 1 Corinthians 7:25 following is, now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think in view of the present distress, it's good for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned, and if a betrothed woman marries, she's not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. This is what I mean, brothers. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods. And those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it, for the present form of this world is passing away. See, here he speaks in terms of eschatology, in terms of the age to come, in which we are now participating. It comes in several forms. Firstly, there is the present, it's not impending, that's a wrong translation, distress. We don't know what that present distress was he's speaking of here, but whatever it is, it's part of the larger change coming upon the world. For verse 29 tells us the appointed time has grown very short. And verse 30, the present form of this world is passing away. So we do not look at this world as non-Christians look at this world. We have an eschatological look at this world, an expectation, which explains and anticipates the troubles we're going through. These are part of the messianic woes of the parousia starting upon us. Secondly, there is the general command of verses 17 to 24 to remain as we are. So if you're single, remain single. If you're married, remain married. He uses the word of binding and loosing. I don't think having been loosed is the perfect, actually, is I think the ESV is right to translate it not in that kind of perfect sense. Some people use it as a way of talking about, this is talking about divorce, having been loosed. But I think the parallel, are you bound, are you loosed, is to be rightly seen that way. It's part of seeing as from the aspect rather than worrying about the perfect tense. But thirdly, there is the concept of avoiding worldly trouble. For the married inevitably have to be concerned about the things of the world, especially in times of persecution. Remember Mark 13? And alas for women who are pregnant, and for those who are nursing infants in those days. My dear brothers, we do need, as married men, according to 1 Peter chapter 3, to live with understanding of our woman, of our wives as weaker vessels. It's not to say they are vessels and we're not vessels. By saying they're weaker vessels, we're saying we also are vessels. But it is pointing to the bodily state that we must pay attention to. And the use of the word there, the woman, actually is a very unusual word, only used once in the New Testament, but it's used in the LXX of women in Genesis 18. It's talking about the reproductive processes of women. That in itself creates a vulnerability. Ever since the fall, it has created a vulnerability. And while men go through life with just one process of getting older, women go through phases and stages of life, which is expressed in their bodies, premenstrual, postmenstrual, that whole period. But it's also that they go through different phases of life socially, as they marry, as they have children, as their children age, as they move. It's a whole series of phases of life that women go through that men don't actually pass through to the same extent and in the same way. It is a great folly to talk about persons as persons and not talk about humans as male and female, husbands and wives, men and women. For I do not treat men as the same as I treat women, and I should not. I must treat women with absolute purity, not by any means thinking that I don't need to treat men with absolute purity, but I don't need to have that said to me as I do on the subject of younger women in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 1 and 2, if you don't recognise it. So this difference that is there is an important difference, especially family life, when you come to persecution. For there is great disadvantage in times of persecution, suffering and difficulty to be caught up in family responsibilities. Every kind of action movie you see, when in the beginning of it they're setting the scene and the hero is shown with his family and his little children, especially one little daughter, you know that you're being told somewhere down the program the baddies are going to kidnap the daughter. Just at the point when he looks like he's beaten them, suddenly you'll get the little telephone call from the daughter saying, "Daddy, can you come and rescue me?" And the whole movie can start again for the last third of the thing as he actually destroys everything in sight except his little girl. There is a standard Hollywood because it's real, because it's true, because it touches our feelings, it moves us, that the hero must protect. If you want to be a hero in an action movie, don't marry and certainly don't have children. And if you choose, go for a boy. He might be able to help you. The little girl with her doll, you're in big trouble, aren't you? So he is saying there is great advantage in being single in these times. In the creation now, there's advantage in being married. There's the joys of children. There's disadvantages in being married. There's the pain of children. But under the light of the eschatological messianic woes, there is real worries in being married. We Sydney Christians don't live under that feeling of messianic woe. But how would you like to be a Nigerian Christian, or in Rwanda, or in South Sudan? Your attitude to the messianic woes would be very different, and your attitude to taking responsibility in marriage, I suggest to you, would be very different. Fourthly, there's the issue of the undivided heart that I read to you earlier from verses 29 to 34. Now, given all this, Paul's advice is not to marry. Not unless you're feeling you're doing the wrong by your virgin. That is, I take it the translation's incorrect here, that she's aging and the time for children is passing. But his advice is carefully qualified as his advice. It's not the rule or law, for to marry is not to sin. It's just that you're living in this creation and will have to bear the burdens of this creation when you in fact have come to the age to come, and could already be taking up that lifestyle, living not for your spouse and children, but for the Lord himself. Celibacy, singleness, as a choice for the Christian person, is a very real choice that I think we have put on the back burner far too much. And in so doing, Paul is laying the foundation for those who will choose to remain single for the cause of the gospel. Just as some will choose to renounce their work, their career for the cause of the gospel, so some will choose to renounce marriage and children for the cause of the gospel. Some of the great evangelical leaders of the 20th century were, in particular, men who, in the movement in England, chose singleness. And the blessings of some of these single men have been enormous upon our lives. We know of our own local here, John Chapman, but John Stott is a classic illustration of a man who chose to be single out of the cause of the gospel. But there's a whole string of these men who have travelled the world and been great blessing and benefit to people in a way that could not have been possible had they married and had children. It's a choice that we have been blessed with, and it's a choice that we must have as a real choice. Just as we can be seduced by the created order into materialism and individualism, for both in part are true, so we can be seduced by the created order into marriage and family life instead of renouncing all for the sake of serving Christ single-mindedly. Luke chapter 14, great crowds accompanied Jesus, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and doesn't hate his own father, mother, and wife, and children, and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." As Luther wrote in his great hymn, "And though they take our life, goods, honour, children, wife, yet is their profit small. These things shall vanish all. The city of God remaineth." This is living as Paul commanded in verse 29. "From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none." Not at all meaning go into ascetic state of celibacy and never touch your wife. For within marriage, that would not be right. He's denied that back in verses 1 to 5. "Forbidding marriage and sexual pleasure is the work of the demon. But sitting loosely to marriage to avoid the sin of mariolatry, where my life's meaning is to be found there. For my life's meaning is not to be found in my marriage here, but in Christ's marriage with his bride there." Okay, now I think I've set the scene for singleness and ministry. There's one other issue that needs to be picked up, that is the pastorals, where the elders are to be married, manage their own household. I don't believe they're the ordained Bible teachers, the missionaries. I think that more college trains. Rather, that's the lay leadership of the local church settled in their town. It's not Timothy, Titus, Silvanus, Paul, whose lives are better suited to singleness. However, I would argue for the rightness of singleness in ministry. Indeed, it's better rather than worse. Though I would be opposed to insisting upon it like Roman Catholicism, and the vows of celibacy are actually abhorrent. But in commending singleness in ministry, I would draw attention to the fact that there are different reasons for singleness, and your different reasons will affect how you minister as a single person. There's different degrees of contentment, and that will affect how you minister as a single person. There's different ability to rejoice with others without envy as they enjoy the benefits of created marriage. And the costs, well, the costs for the single person are much the same as the cost for the married person. Chapo taught me that. It cost him about as much to live as it cost me, though I had a family of four dependents and he had none. His lifestyle was a much more expensive lifestyle than mine. Holidays for me, days off for me was simple. Just go out in the backyard with a cup of tea and play cricket with the kids. That was not his option, you see. It's a very much more complicated thing than just say, oh, well, they're single, they don't. We mustn't think like that. Single people have the same costs, the same difficulties, the same disappointments of this world. But they do have greater flexibility. It is easier to be an itinerant and to go into dangerous grounds. I chatted to a couple of men and women recently about this asking for today. And it was interesting, the women saw being single created certain advantages, but the man said to me, oh, being single gives me greater courage to do things. And I checked with the women and none of them had greater courage because they were single. Not one of them. But the man said, if I'm single, I can go and take risks. And sometimes that's what we need. The congregational preference for married ministers is just an indication of how middle class our congregations are. Do you want to ask questions then?